It's time for an Insight program, and we have a couple of in-studio guests. Tri-County Healthcare CEO Joel Beiswinger, Dr. Ben Hess joins us as well. And here we are, guys. This is what do we want to officially call this? Another talk, a COVID-19 talk.
Maybe an update.
Maybe an update. We can call it that. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate you guys being here. And let's just dive right into it. We want to talk about and address COVID-19, I guess specifically what's impacting our community, the state of things in the area. Joel, is that where you want to jump in?
Yeah, thank you, Corey, for having us on. Yes, it's another visit of COVID-19 about 18 months after we did this the first time.
Yeah.
And multiple visits between. So status report right now is things are still very high in terms of community prevalence. Here in our area, we regularly track what's going on in Wadena County, Todd County, and Otter Tail County. And even though, thankfully, over the last 10 days or so, we're starting to, it looks like we've seen a plateau and things are improving. But to give you a sense, Wadena County has 136 cases per 10,000. As a frame of reference, 50 was the plan that the schools lived with last year, where they were, at that point, supposed to be working towards full remote learning.
Wow.
So we're significantly over that. And what that's doing is putting a lot of strain on both the local health system at Tri-County Healthcare, our neighbors around the area, as well as across the whole state and region. So and Ben will cover a little bit later. We're having a lot of difficulty getting patients transferred out. We have a lot of activity happening with our building. So things are still tough. Don't take the fact that we're hearing a little bit of good news too positively yet, because it could still ebb and flow. And COVID is still amongst us and will continue to be amongst us, unfortunately, for some time, I believe.
So let's talk maybe a little logistically with Tri-County Healthcare. Dr. Hess, what does it mean, I guess, for you guys in particular as staff at Tri-County? Are you seeing strains on the staff in the building?
Yeah, I think so. We're dealing with a couple of things. We've gotten back to our full capacity normally, so we're doing our usual surgical procedures, and we're seeing the usual time of the year illnesses. On top of that, we've got additional bed demands and hospitalizations for COVID-related patients. And so we're at full capacity in the hospital, which means that we're essentially full every day. Mm-hmm. There may be some discharges, there may be some new admits that immediately fill those beds, but we've been running at that capacity for probably about 3 or 4 weeks. Now, normally for us, we're used to running at about half to three quarters capacity. We can certainly flex up with our staff to full capacity in the hospital, but it's hard to sustain that. That's typically asking people to come in on their days off. That's asking them to do double shifts and work extra. And that's where we're starting to see, you know, the wear and tear on our staff and the fatigue that we're running into with everybody dealing with this.
Where is the difficulty? What comes in then as far as the patients and moving them around? Is there transferring of patients that needs to happen because of full capacity?
Yes, that's another problem we're seeing right now that probably is worse this year than it was even last year during our COVID peak, because I think just Delta is making people more ill and they're sick longer, and so it's just kept our hospitals full. We're at a point now where we can't find a bed when we need it, both locally and transferring out to a bigger hospital. So if somebody comes in and they need an ICU bed, we have been spending days trying to find an ICU bed, which means that we are managing that patient locally, which is a much more complex, much sicker patient than our staff is typically used to dealing with. And so we have that strain as well for our staff. And we're at a point too where patients are waiting for beds in our own hospital in the ER for hours and sometimes even a day or better, because we just need to discharge somebody before we can admit them to an open bed in our hospital. So mm-hmm. We're running into all of that. We normally transfer to places like Fargo, St. Cloud, sometimes the cities, but we're at this point looking for any open bed in the state, and we're also likewise getting requests when we happen to have an open bed. Other facilities are contacting us now and asking us if, you know, we can accept them. I think we've gotten requests from as far away as La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
So one of the other things that's interesting and different about this wave, last year, the larger facilities, the big regional facilities like Fargo and St. Cloud, had more staffing. They brought temporary staff in. They actually stood up special COVID units. So they saw their bed capacity increase temporarily by 40, 60, 80 beds in those facilities. So our ability to transfer was actually a lot better last year. This year they haven't been able to do that because the staff just aren't there. So it means that we're seeing in our rural facilities like us an interesting phenomenon. About a month ago, when we look at all of the COVID cases in the state of Minnesota, more are being cared for in rural Minnesota than in those urban and suburban and regional sites. So it's a very unique situation that we're facing, and it's putting, again, that's the strain that's on the system right now.
So this is a strain that's on the system post a positive test. These are positive COVID-19 cases. What is the constraints that you're seeing pre, I guess, in that testing process? Is that something that exists right now too?
Yeah, we are running into shortages for testing, and at the same time we're seeing an increased demand for that. With the schools open, there is we're seeing 50 or 60 people a day at times in our urgent care, ready care area looking for COVID testing. Now, thankfully this week, the Wadena Armory has opened up a testing site a couple of days a week, Mondays and Tuesdays, I believe. And so that will help with some of that testing shortages. But it's a combination of staff availability, just getting people, that number of people through the building, as well as being able to restock our testing supplies, because that's a nationwide shortage, and we just can't keep up with the demand.
And one of the frustrations that we've had in the past 2 months really now is as the schools have gotten open and there's been more prevalence coming, and you know, parents wanting to get their kids tested and turned around now so they can, if they're negative, go back to their lives.
Mm-hmm.
We unfortunately have had to go to very limited capabilities on our quick turnaround test.
Mm-hmm.
Again, just because there aren't supplies. It's not because we don't want to. It's not, we understand the difficulty that these poor parents have under any situations, but the supplies are just not available, and we have to be very restrictive and limited on who we can do those on.
Right. We're limiting those tests, those rapid tests, those immediate tests, to the critical patients. So essentially anybody, sure, that's coming to the hospital or needs to be transferred or is critically ill where they might need additional treatments that rely on a positive test, we're really reserving the limited stock we have for those scenarios, and so that just means that the rest of the patients will end up having a send-out test that can take a day or two to return.
So to kind of bring this back around to the initial point of this kind of set of questioning, then back to the staff, is this something, are you seeing, is it really burnout, fatigue sort of situation you're seeing on staff in the hospital?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of that. It's all of that. It's the workload. I think it's the frustration. I think we're also bumping up into sometimes the public coming in, not believing our advice, not taking our recommendations. They trust us wholly for the rest of their care, but for this particular item, it's become so political for some people.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't trust us. And I think as a primary care provider, that's one of the reasons I came into this job, was to build relationships with people and build that trust. And
mm-hmm.
and you know, you sometimes take it personally, and you try and keep it professional, but at the end of the day, you go home and you just feel defeated and you just feel frustrated at mm-hmm. times with that lack of public trust and awareness sometimes.
And,
go ahead.
And we're seeing it. There's actually been a very interesting wave of stress and strain on the healthcare providers and the system. I look back to when COVID started. We all thought it was going to be a quick spike, quick turnaround, and you know, this would be a 6 to 8 week phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we had the strain at that time of really shutting everything down. March of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody worked their tails off, you know, getting temporary policies, protocols, facility changes, everything that we had to figure out in a very short order. And then it was waiting for our wave, which really never came for us in the spring and summer of 2020. I've actually coined the term pre-traumatic stress syndrome, because it was the stress of waiting for something that we think might come. Excuse me. And then when we actually got our wave in the fall, after we had resumed some of our regular activity, it was that stress. And then as we turned into winter and spring, everything was kind of back to normal. Everybody was feeling pretty good. And then we got this late summer wave that is now still persisting. So there hasn't really been a great time of rest for folks. And you stack one set of pressures on top of the other now for approaching 20 months. And it's just people are tired. They're wore out. They're tired, frustrated. And then we marry that with the very unfortunate situation we're in from a kind of societal perspective and the political perspective on this stuff, that, you know, it's hard for the folks who believe one thing to even have a conversation with the folks that believe something else. So that's adding stress to the system and just to everybody that's working in healthcare today.
Joel, one of the things we talked about back in March of 2020 when we had this conversation the first time was the use of a mask. Can you talk about a little bit where we're at as far as mask use today? What should we be doing? When should we be using one? Should we be using one? Where are we at?
So still we go back in time. You know, masks were our really only tool at that time. I think we all hoped for that we'd have a better tool. The vaccines have been that tool. So as a healthcare provider community and advocates, we are still saying vaccine is our best tool. Masking is still a very valid and capable tool for us, a mitigation effort. If you, for some reason, can't be vaccinated, and there are folks in that place or those that just are choosing not to, masking is still something that you should be doing. You're masking for source control to help protect others, but it also does provide protection for yourself as well. So the hospital right now has a mask mandate for everybody in the building. There are different levels of masks required based upon the type of work that our staff are doing or the environment that they might be in, whether it's a higher risk or lower risk environment. So we've learned a lot about that as well. So again, we continue to advocate wear your masks when you're in closed places, in large groups, in large group settings. Outside seems to be relatively safe, so apply some good judgment to it, and I think most people can be okay.
In that mix, you did talk about vaccination. In the notes here, it says herd immunity. Obviously, that the vaccination process is something we continue to hear about. Now it looks like things approved for that school age group, right? Is it 5 to 11 years old, I think, is the new, or 5 to 12? Any additional comments or anything to say about that vaccination process?
Yeah, I might let Ben talk more about that, other than I think we are within a few days of getting the final approval and the system set up for our vaccines for the 5 through 11 age kids. Again, everything that is coming, what I'm seeing is it is safe for our kids. But again, Ben is much more of an expert at that than I.
Sure. Yeah, I would agree that we're close to having an answer on that, at least an emergency use authorization for children in that age category, which is, I think right now, a big gap across the country for us, because we know from other diseases that age group often shares these things the best, the fastest, and is probably a significant source for some of the community spread. So the sooner we can get them protected and shut down the transmission in the schools and the classrooms, I think the better off we will be as a community as well. And, you know, at this point now, we have done over 3 billion with a B vaccines in the world. And I think we've had adequate time now to figure out if there's any long-term or short-term side effects with it. And these really are turning out to be some of the safest vaccines out there, despite what you might hear or read about on online or social media. I think from a medical perspective, from the science perspective, these are very good, very safe vaccines that we have available in this country. And they have done a very good job of monitoring it and evaluating it and keeping us up to date if there have been any concerns. There are a few that have popped up, but I think what people don't always have the perspective on is that the side effects that have shown up in some of the COVID vaccines, things like myocarditis and blood clots, actually occur more often with the actual COVID disease than they do with the vaccine. Myocarditis is a really good example, which has come up with some of the mRNA vaccines, and the rate is somewhere around 12 cases per million shots.
Mm-hmm.
But with COVID, you can get 2% of the cases of COVID will have myocarditis associated with it. So 12 out of a million versus 2% is a big difference in the risk there. And again, myocarditis sounds scary, but it's actually a self-limited disease that typically people completely recover from with treatment as simple as ibuprofen at home for a couple of weeks and rest.
Sure.
So, you know, if that's the worst side effect I'm seeing from the vaccine, then we are doing very well with it, and really it needs to become an important tool for us. You know, I think the other aspect that should help people is that doctors are making recommendations to patients all the time about treatments. It's our job to be skeptical. It's our job to look at the evidence, to weigh the studies, and to make judgments and recommendations to people.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm making a recommendation to somebody that's dangerous or unproven, you know, that can be on me. So I'm very careful about what I want to say and endorse. Mm-hmm. And we are at a point now where 97% of the doctors in the country have gotten vaccinated. So I can't remember a time where I've ever seen 97% of my colleagues agree on something.
Yeah.
We can always usually find some way to nitpick that. But if we can agree on that, I think that should be reassuring to the public that we're all doing our research and we're all coming to the same conclusion. And so I think that should give people some reassurance as well.
Yeah, there's actually a concept in healthcare that we are held to by, you know, like the Medicare agency, other regulators, our accrediting bodies, and even our risk insurers. It's called informed consent. So if you ever go in for surgery, there's a process that the physicians and the nurse goes through with you to say, here are the risks and the potential side effects or ramifications of this. Here's the benefits. So that informed consent concept is not new. This is something that we have practiced in healthcare for decades. And again, it's the physician, your physician, your primary care physician is your best source for information. That's the thing I've been telling people these last several months is please don't rely on social media and your friends and relatives for your information on medical advice. Talk to your family physician. They'll do what's best for you and advise you according to what they know about your case and care.
Dr. Hess, you mentioned stuff in schools. We talked about that 5 to 11 age group. We're also running up on a time now where we're really talking about this. It's an every year thing, cold and flu season. So now we're doubling up on that. What are we seeing the impacts at the hospital? And I guess we want to talk about, you know, that the flu vaccine. Are these things we can do together?
Yes.
Can we take both? I'll just let you kind of fill in the blanks on an open-ended statement rather than a question.
Sure. No, I think, again, going back to last year when we had the masking in the schools, one of the comments I heard over and over again from parents, from teachers, was that, you know what, this year with everybody masking, we're not seeing anybody out for illness. We're not seeing any colds. We're not seeing any influenza. We were testing for it, despite what the public seems to think, that, you know, we were still checking for that. I can recall a handful, like literally about 6 cases of influenza last year that we actually tested for. Mm-hmm. That's how well the masks shut down disease spread of everything, not just COVID, in the schools. So this year, we're obviously not masking as aggressively. The guidelines have loosened quite a bit in most schools. But we are seeing a resurgence of all the usual cold and flu stuff. We are seeing RSV this time of the year, quite bad cases, which is unusual. Typically, RSV is more of a springtime, early or late winter disease. So this is like a 6-month off-cycle outbreak that's a little unusual. But that's added to some of the burden in the hospital. We're seeing a few hospitalized kids from RSV, not from COVID. So that's another problem that's adding to everything. I think the anybody in school now that has their usual sniffles or seasonal allergies or whatever it might be, there's a very high likelihood it's COVID until you prove otherwise. I'm starting to lose track of my kids' school and the parents and the teachers and their friends that have gone home because, well, it turns out that headache they had for 3 days was COVID. Oh, it turns out their stomach bug was COVID. Oh, it turns out their sniffles were COVID. And then those kids go home, and then I'm seeing their grandparents usually in the hospital, typically unvaccinated grandparents, that said, oh, yeah, my little grandson was over a couple of weeks ago and had a fever or had a cold, and now I have COVID. And they're putting two and two together and figuring out that that's probably their most likely exposure. And so, you know, I think people have to realize and take some precautions still that the kids are not as sick as the adults, and it's being under tested right now.
Is there, I'm going to, before I let you guys give your final thoughts and let you guys go for the day, there is obviously, we talked about fatigue in the building itself as far as staff. What is the advice out there for folks who are, you mentioned the sniffles. It's also a brand new school year. That is one of the things that just comes with being around more people. The fatigue and the tiredness that can come from, like, all right, you had a week of sniffles, then nothing, and then a week later there's more sniffles with someone. You know what? There's that kind of beat down, I guess, in that process. Is there any advice, or is this maybe out of your jurisdiction a little bit, on staying diligent knowing that COVID is still out there in the world?
Yeah, I think it is going to be hard, and I understand that, and mm-hmm. I think that's part of the frustration we've had with the testing shortages, but I mm-hmm. think the advice right now, especially in the middle of this peak, is that you should be testing regularly, testing often if you're not sure. And if you do have the sniffles, why aren't you wearing a mask? Why aren't you taking precautions? Stay away from that birthday party. Stay away from that large gathering. Anything you were doing last fall when we had our outbreak is probably the right recommendation now. So I know people aren't mandated to wear masks, but I would highly encourage it for everybody right now, because that will be the fastest way to melt this surge away and get us back to more normal operations and give us a chance to catch up on some of these vaccinations in the populations that really haven't been treated yet or haven't gotten there yet. So that's what I think we really need to do. The Armory is an option. I know the schools now have the access to some testing themselves for their students. And I think we really just need to do this for everybody in our community, not just you know, your own personal needs, because there are people now that are having heart attacks and strokes that can't find a hospital bed. It has nothing to do with COVID, but they are not getting the standard of care that they deserve because of that lack of bed of space.
Is there any final thoughts, Dr. Hess, that you want to make sure? That sounded like a pretty good summary right there, I thought.
Yeah, I think that's really the point I want to drive home now, I think, is that you're not just doing this for yourself or your family. You're doing it for your community, and you're doing it for loved ones. And, you know, we are doing everything we can in the hospital for our patients and for your loved ones, but we are running into the reality of not enough beds, not enough nurses, not enough of anything right now. So we're really asking for the public's help in doing what they can as well.
Joel?
Yeah, and I think on top of that is there's been a lot of talk recently that, you know, COVID is with us and with us permanently, probably. You know, I don't think this is just, we're not going to have an end to COVID, in my opinion, right now. The way that we can start to see it be dealt with as just another disease that we work with or potentially get is through herd immunity. And we get to herd immunity a few ways, but unfortunately, just because you've had COVID, it really only gives you some of that protection for about 90 days. So vaccine, again, still the best tool. And if you're concerned about the vaccine, I get it. There's a lot of folks who have real valid concerns. Then use the other mitigation techniques of masking. So this is with us. It's going to be with us, and so that we can help keep the health system afloat, and that so that we're here for you when you have that heart attack or stroke or broken limb, that we can care for you timely and, you know, using the best standards. In some cases, that means getting you to the next level of care that we don't, for something that we don't do here regularly. you know, none of us want to be told, I'm sorry, you'll have to wait with your broken hip for a few days because there's not space for you. And that's where the public can help us through whatever the best mitigation technique is for the individual.
Thank you so much, guys. That is Tri-County Healthcare CEO Joel Beiswinger, Dr. Ben Hess. Thanks.
Thank you.